That is what's happening now. And you're the co-host. I'll make you the host. And okay, cool. So, Charmaine, have a good one, and I'll see y'all all soon.
Have an amazing weekend. Stay safe.
All right.
Hi, Charmaine. We're so glad you could join us. I'm just going to say the date and the names. So it's Friday, July 21st, and I'm Ava Sullivan Thomas, and I'm here with
Anna Sophia Harrison,
Autumn Johnson.
And we're just going to start with, could you tell me the year you were born and where?
I was born in 1969 in New York City at Roosevelt Hospital on 59th Street and 10th Avenue.
Thank you. Can you speak a little about your experience living and growing up in New York City and what made it unique for you?
I grew up in, it's had various different names, but for me, it's always Harlem. You know, but they call it Morningside Heights. Some people call it the Valley. I grew up on the corner of 125th Street and Amsterdam Avenue in a New York City project building. And what made it unique was because it was its own melting pot. And it was like one giant mesh family, even though, as in all families, this one doesn't like this one and that one doesn't like that one. But when it came time to protect one another, or especially with the children, you know, that's when it pulled together. That's what I remember the most. And I didn't know we were poor.
I know in your pre-interview, you mentioned you don't know who your father is, but could you tell me about your mother?
So I am the product of a 16-year-old heroin addict and an unknown DNA donor. My mom, from what I've been told, made it clear that she didn't want me. You know, my mom left me in the hospital. And my grandmother left me there, too. But because of pressure, because one lady, and I love her to death, you know, she's a blessing and a curse, because sometimes I wonder if my life would have been better had I stayed there and been in foster care, you know. But the lady, Miss Sheridan, she was, because she came and she told my grandmother that my mom left me. And I was there, left, to detox with her heroin. But then the lady started pressuring my grandma, like, I don't see none of y'all up there. I haven't seen none of you Smiths up there to see that baby. You know, and I believe my grandmother came to get me just to show faith, to save faith. You know, because, you know, nobody was, oh, not only the mother left him, the grandmother left him too. You know, and that one action there was the foundation of my childhood. I was always told that. I was lucky. My mother didn't want me, she left me. Even sometimes now today, and I just turned 54, it still resurfaces that less than feeling. And because of that, I suffer from, like, various differences, you know. One of the biggest ones is imposter syndrome, because I feel like anything that I accomplish, I don't deserve, and somebody's going to come take it. And, you know, for a lot of many years, my pride was like, well, I'm not going to let anybody take it, when really nobody wasn't coming for it. But that was so deeply planted in me that it was before I let anybody take it, I'm a mess with my own self. And I lost quite a bit of, I lost, you know, I missed out on a lot of opportunities, you know, because life would be just, in my eyes, too good. Somebody's going to come take it. So before I let somebody else mess me up, I'm a mess with my own self. And it doesn't go away that easy. Are you there? Hello?
Yeah, we're here. Sorry. Oh. I was just going to, Ana Sofia, do you want to go on to the next set of questions?
Yeah, sure. Thank you for telling us a bit about that. So what would you mind speaking now about also what led to your incarceration?
So again, I suffered various different childhood traumas, the greatest one being that I was never going to be good enough and I didn't deserve anything. So okay, first I tried the good way. I excelled in school, this and that, and I didn't get the affection from my, what I call today my relatives, you know. And but I noticed that if I did things wrong, everybody knew about it. Everybody had something to say. And because of these different things, you know, one of them including molestation, I searched and sought acceptance any way I could. And so one of my seeking of affection was I left New York and followed a gentleman to Buffalo. And I became addicted to drugs there. And when I thought I couldn't take it no more, I called my grandma. She did come home. I came back to New York. That monster was still there. So all of my incarcerations, not just one or two, all of my incarcerations are the result of a very deadly and unfriendly substance use disorder, which was precipitated by me wanting to feel in a crowd that I now don't say I had no business in anyway. But, you know, not wanting to be alone. Just not even not wanting to be alone, wanting to be accepted. Just anybody to tell me that I'm okay, that I matter.
Thank you. What was your experience like seeking treatment for substance abuse while incarcerated? And did you face any barriers?
So it's ironic because prior to incarceration and prior to, so let me just backtrack a little bit. So in 2000, I went to Phoenix House and, you know, it was as a result of my grandmother saying, like, you better do something. And before that, I had sought treatment. So, and each one came with a stipulation. Like, are you, and this is pre any type of incarceration. Do you have a case pending? Do you have children? All these things were barriers because, no, at the time, I didn't have a child. At that time, I had no, me, get arrested? No. You know? And I'm stubborn. I'm headstrong. So at 40 years old, I got arrested. Five years prior, I had a child by someone that I met in treatment, who the minute I said, I think I'm pregnant, they were gone. But again, it was my choice, and I thought I'd never could have children. And so I gave birth to a son. And I gave birth to a son that was addicted, you know, that was had drugs in his system. But, you know, knowing that I had a problem, like maybe it was so ironic, not even like 5 days before I signed up for outpatient, and then I had my baby. And the hospital didn't tell me right away, so I thought I got away unscathed. So when they came and they told me that my child had drugs in the system, the ECS had been called, I counted me. I called the outpatient program. So at that point in time, minimal stipulation because prior to giving birth, I had already exhibited the need or the desire to get help. So that first ACS case was closed. Notice I say first. And then, you know, the reality of what was going on, like, hit me. I'm 35 years old, with a child, that I have no clue, you know. And in my eighth month, I had relapse. So now, again, my best friend is back in the picture, and my child is vying for the attention of my best friend, you know. And, like, I made sure my son, you know, when ACS would come to my house, like, there would be food. There would be, you know, what was necessary. But I used drugs. And 2005, I said, okay, I'll go to treatment, you know. And my aunt had agreed to take my son for the $28 treatment. And then we had a transit strike. And like I sometimes say God has a funny sense of humor, because I actually currently live now 2 blocks away from where they removed my son. And, you know, I was seen as being uncooperative or non-compliant, because I'm telling you, the treatment center that told me I need to be at 7 o'clock in the morning. You call me at 1 o'clock and tell me that you had a ride. And I said, well, that's not going to work because, you know, and I'm asking all the questions to protect me. So what happens if I get to 57th Street and 5th Avenue and they don't have a bed for me? How do I make it to Houston and Avenue D? And I offered, you know, the lady, well, listen, you can take my son. Take my son and take him to my aunt. And I will go to treatment. And then it dawned on me, if I'm in treatment, I wouldn't see my son for a second Christmas. And I asked, please, can I stay here after Christmas? And I'll never forget it. It was December 23rd, 2005, that the ACS supervisor and another person knocked on my door. And again, I had just moved there 3-4 days earlier, so who knows where I live? And you know, I'm grateful because most times you see ATF removals, it's a caseworker, a screaming child, the police. And she felt that we had that much of a rapport that, you know, I understand the brevity of my actions, and it wouldn't be a scene. So she didn't bring the police, you know. And I begged and pleaded, you know, like I didn't say I wouldn't go, but this lady wanted me to leave at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and what happens if I don't get in? That's all I wanted to know. You know, but then the other caseworker, he went to court and got an emergency removal order. And like 10:30 at night, I walked my son down to the van, and I asked where my son gonna go. And they were like, oh, we put your aunt out. And I'm like, how do you know? And they're like, oh, we talked to her already, you know, which again opened up that door. I'm not good enough, you know. They call me to say these people coming to my son. No. Then tell the people that I had asked my family for help 3 or 4 times, and their help is still taking my child from one day to say, come get your kid. So again, December 23rd, 2005, my son was removed, and they would teach to come back when you come to court tomorrow and give a urine test. Well, we all know my urine almost burned a hole through the car. My son saved my life. I did go to treatment, and but when I came back, my best friend was gone. You know, my son. And that was the beginning of the end for me, you know, because, again, somebody's always taking something from me. Thus began my history of incarceration, to the point where I knew the police and they knew me. Where are you going? oh, I'm going so-and-so. You want to check me? Do I need to? Well, if you feel to, and, you know, them realizing or not realizing, the taunting was a tactic. Because back then, and I don't know if it still exists, if the police stop you, they can't message you for 90 minutes. So I would engage and, you know, oh, we got to call a few more. So go ahead, call us. You know, because I'm saying to myself, when I finish, I can go call, but they can't message me. They can't do anything. You know, like just stop, let me see. They can't do it. You have to wait 90 minutes. You know, so that was that. And I began to develop what I call a one crack mind. Because I lost the job. So I didn't have. Matter of fact, I didn't move in with a job. I was a assistant certificate. And back then it was only $63. And, you know, the mind is twisted. The mind has definitely, you know, the mind has definitely, you know, put out some self-sabotaging ways where, you know, on both sides. Because I would know that I had to go see my son on a certain day, and I couldn't say 2:15 or 2:25, and then get upset with my aunt who does have him, and has very nice labor. He had him so much he had for $41, you know? And it's like, it was just a series of, like, again, still trying to fit in, you know? Still trying to feel or fake myself into feeling that I'm normal, that nothing is wrong with me, you know? And that plays into physical, mental, psychological, all of them, you know? And that, you know, that did it, you know?
Thank you for sharing that. As someone who has been, has experienced society's form of carceral punishment, in response to substance abuse, what has your experience been helping people through community-based services?
Well, anyone who knows me, right, knows that my motto is no one gets left behind. Because I got left behind so many times. You know, when I was released from incarceration, it was like, never ask where you're going, never ask what you're going to do, never ask anything. Just thrown back into quote-unquote society, potentially even angrier than I went in because they had the nerve to keep me. So, I treat everybody equal until you show me there's a reason to treat you different. Because I say, as long as somebody's in the book, I can deal. You don't have to be on the same page. But our goal is the same. To stay, live, and die clean. That's it. I've sent so many people to detox from my home. Yeah, that's good.
Thank you for sharing that. Can you talk about some of the hardships you faced upon reentry after incarceration, and maybe how those hardships led you to the CWP?
So Memorial Day 2009, I got arrested, you know, and I went to jail. And the first time I went to jail, it was like 15 years. I couldn't even fathom 15 days, right? So the thing about it is right, never have been, I thank God, been stupid or uneducated. And thinking about, like, how much work is the public defender really going to do for me, and they have, like, 1,000 people. I took it upon myself. I wrote a letter to the judge. And what I said was, no, I'm not going to say the police tricked me. No, I'm not going to say that I didn't do it. What I am going to say is that I'm a person that is in the throes of an addiction that I know nothing about. And I did what I needed to do to survive. You know, I was always too scared to steal or whatever, at least at that time. You know, and when I returned back to court, and I'm together, his name is just Carol. And he said, I got a letter from somebody. And I was like, you know, this is my first real, like, introduction into the criminal justice arena, you know. This is a bit more than I'm going to the pen and I'm going to get a ticket and I'm going to get out. No. And so he said, did you write that? I'm like, yes, I did. You know, and he said, what did it say? I said, well, I can't say what it said for me. However, I would like for you to, you know, consider that I'm, you know, basically, I'm like, I'm not a bad person. But as a result of this ugly addiction, like, I'm doing what I can to get what at the specific time I felt I believed. I need it. And when I finished talking, like, you know, some people, they got stuck by their eyeballs, and I finished, they were over his nose. And he said, Marie, I'm going to do you a favor. I was like, oh, shoot, he can rain. Let me go home. He said, I'm going to adjourn your case for 6 months. I couldn't figure out how the luck was that. He said, figure it out. I read this and I started researching. And I realized that the Rockefeller drug law was going to go into place. The drug law repeal was going to go into place. And guess what? Instead of going to pool in the summer, I'm going to pop in the summer. You know, so that's how it started. You know, again, the looking for love, making acquaintances with some unsavory characters. And again, you know, the most important thing, and I still keep that up front because I now still live in that neighborhood, I have to be careful of trying to be shaped, built, whatever, like me. You know, so this is taking me, you know, this is purging for me. It's a purge.
That's really interesting. How you wrote a letter to the judge. Thanks for including that. I just wanted to talk about how you got involved with the Coalition for Women Prisoners. If you could speak to that a little bit.
So what happened was, as a result of the judge's favor, right? Sitting on record out of 6 months, I was able to go to an ATI, which is an alternative to incarceration. And I went to Green Hope Services for Women, which at the time was located in the little convent of a church on 119 between Pleasant and First. And I had no clue what CWP was. Nothing, you know, but because I was quiet, whatever. You know, I was one of the people that had a story about adoption. And they were like, you're going to go to this agency and you want to go to Albany, but you have to dress nice and stuff like that. So, mind you, I just got there. You said, did I want to go to the moon with only one helmet? I wanted to get out of the building and find out what I was walking out the building and getting into until I got into the car that I was assigned to. And the people talking about, yeah, I'm motion this and that and this and that, you know. I don't know, who are we going? And I don't have no clue what dance is going to be required of me to dance. And one lady said,
Serena Liguori. Love Serena. She's now in the hierarchy of, you know, Muscle Brown. But he would always have something interesting and vinegar to say. You know, good morning, young lady. And it would be a joke. And he made me not invisible to me. You know.
So you were a part of the campaign to pass the Adoption and Safe Families Act?
Yes. We got there as Serena and I forgot the other lady's name. As we're driving to Albany, that's when I find out what we're doing. Like, this is not no ordinary just field trip. This field trip has a purpose. Well, to me, like, I was picked because of my situation. So we get up there, and there's a flashlight, and, you know, flashing lights, movie characters, and all that stuff. So I'll never forget, first Delmonette Montgomery gets up, talks about the bill and why they want the bill passed, and, you know, then Senator Diane Savino, she gets up, and, you know, she talks about the importance of it, how the reason it was initiated was a good idea, but it fell through. And then one day, you know, led to another. But, you know, and then after they finished talking, it was Delmonette, Diane Savino, at the time, Commissioner Carrion, and then Tamar Crassola. You know, and they were, you know, advocating for it. And then we spoke. And the first person to speak was a young lady, Brunilda. And she had brought her son with us. And he spoke about how, you know, it's different with mom. And then it was me. And I spoke about wanting to be a mother, but never be shown how. You know?
I'm sorry, can you just repeat that last part?
I didn't hear what you said. Say it again.
Can you just repeat the last thing you said?
Oh, so I don't even remember. Gosh, my mind is a blur. So these people spoke and they talk about, you know, why they wanted it to pass. And then the first person that went, her name was Brunilda, and then accompanying with her on the trip was her son, Brandon. And they both talked about it from their angle. And then I went up, you know. And, you know, I talked about how I had my son when I was 35 years old. I didn't know what I was doing. You know. And just because certain things occurred didn't mean I didn't want to be a parent to my son. And then another lady went, Crystal, she talked about her daughter. Yeah.
And around what year was this?
2010. We went to, okay, so I got arrested in May of 2009. We went to Albany maybe May of 2010, and I'll never forget, June 11th, 2010, David Patterson signed into law, asked for expanded discretion.
And how did you feel when the bill finally passed?
I felt grateful that I had played a part, and I felt very, extremely hopeful that no one unwillingly you know, it was too late for me. Too late for me, you know. But maybe someone else, you know, I was glad that it was going to be able to help someone else.
Making kind of a big pivot here, But what made you want to major in forensic psychology at John Jay?
So again, like I said, I grew up in public housing, right? And I grew up in what's called Harlem Valley. So, like, my building was 125th and Amsterdam, the big giant building that has two entrances. And when you look up one hill, you see City College of the City of New York. And then when you look up the other hill, you see Columbia University, right? But then you hear everybody talking about this John Jay College. Like it was hard, like you have to be something special. Go to John. And like, that didn't hit me that. You know what I mean? I was too busy. I wanted to be in Redmond. I wanted to go to St. John. And, you know, certain things happened. I didn't wound up not going. And when I learned, when I followed a man to Buffalo, got addicted to drugs or whatever, but I still reminded myself of certain things. No, in this time, you still have to walk. We want you to walk a senior. I mean, you know, what it was. And, but while I was in Buffalo, I had engaged in schooling at this place called Bryan and Stratton, and I had taken up criminal justice. And then I went to Canisius College, then I went to Erie County Community College. These are things that, like, right now I'm taking up in the Department of Education because I need to know. Canisius, I mean, Bryan and Stratton, yes, I did while I excelled. Once I learned that student loans consume my education, I took them out. But now hindsight is 20/20. How was I able to keep taking them out? I couldn't maintain a 2.0. How was that? And I asked that question because now, after all these years, because I never let go of the dream that one day I would walk again. You know, when you're in elementary school and high school, you don't walk for you. You walk because that's your parents' mandate. The next two, yeah. And at the same time, the majority of my life has been searching and seek out. I've been searching and seeking some type of affection just to belong. Just to belong because, again, the God who I knew before God, my Nana, has filled me with so much joy. I'm not worthy. I'll never have anything. You know, I'm going to be just like my mother, which was one of my biggest motivations behind excelling in anything education. Because we all know what happens when you get puffed up with pride because somebody's calling something that we don't think we deserve. I'll show them. Okay, so what? They saw and they said the same thing. Oh, wait, I'm going to kill myself. You know? And then I would hit myself. Yeah, you know, then when you walk up those steps, you know, like, you're not doing all that to jump off nothing. And then what happens if you jump off something and you don't die? Now you gotta live with the fact that you're failure all over again. You couldn't even kill yourself. But I also realized that, logically, intrinsically, I was killing myself every day.
All right, so the next question is taking another little jump. But we did some research prior to the meeting about how about your answering questions when asked about winning the Malcolm King Award at John Jay. And you quoted, or quoting you, you said that your plan was to be a proprietor of a transitional housing program for formerly incarcerated individuals, and that the program would offer job readiness and various resources and social services to assist them What work have you done recently to work toward this plan?
First of all, I'm getting my education so that I can have a foundation to know what I'm doing. You know, while I was a resident of a three-quarter house, I was also the house manager, you know. While, you know, that one idea is taken on many different facets. I actually have a name for it, and it's called Strong for Strong. Just think about it. I don't know about you, but I'm always the strong person that people go to. And when I need a shoulder, I'll be better off leaning on a wall because nobody's putting their shoulder out there. You know? And Oh, shoot. Okay. So, I don't know. Repeat that question again, because, like, I just went somewhere with that, and I just envisioned, like, a whole big house and people with kids that were happy and, you know, that, to a degree, were able to march to their own drum. That they were able to find out, you know, who they were. And really, really soul search, like, what caused the maladaptive behaviors?
Yeah. No, I think that's a very needed thing. So it's sort of to get, the idea is to, like, get formerly incarcerated individuals together and to have a support system.
It's like I said, it's taken on many facets. I don't know, like, have you guys ever seen Cheers?
Seen what?
Cheers, the TV show Cheers.
No, I haven't. I've heard of it.
Percy Alley, you know. So Cheers is like, whatever the name of it was, it's like the neighborhood bar. And, you know, most of the time, it showed the bar part, you know, but everybody was individuals but collective, you know? And whenever anyone came through the door, some people you knew their name, other people it was a, hey, how you doing? So just somebody's acknowledging that I'm here, you know? And the housing thing, yeah, but, you know, the thing about it is, like, sometimes we wear so many hats. Where do we go to take off our hats? And just be. Whatever it looks like to you. Just be. And be in the presence of people that do the same thing that you do. So that if you come in and you don't speak, they understand. Not what's wrong with her. I don't know who they think they are. And, you know, they have various different compartments, you know, like in Cheers, as fun as a bar and a restaurant. And then you walk back, and let's maybe this relaxation room or a meditation room. And then there may actually be a group room. And because, you know, a lot of times when people go to aftercare, once you finish your aftercare contract, you have no more help. But what happens when you just have that off day? And you just keep down in Woosah. You can't do it at home because you got husband, wife, you got to feel obligation. You can't do it at home because, you know, whatever relationship you're in. Even if it's, you know, ironically, like I have a 4-month-old puppy. I love my puppy, but sometimes that is not the first thing I want to do when I walk in the door to play with you. And deal with your over-affectionateness. You know?
Thank you. Have you taken recent steps to kind of toward this plan?
Well, me personally, I don't have $2 over lunch money. However, when I see certain philanthropy groups and they you know, they'll have a different contest for people that want to start businesses and, you know, promote your ideas. So that's the arena that I've been going in now. And then, you know, the other thing, and this is like, excuse my friends, my shit, is it took me 7 years to get into Georgia. Like, to get into college, period. Because of the different environment that I came out of substance abuse treatment, was exposed to. You know, I was in a three-quarter house. I was sleeping in a bunk bed in a room with seven other women. And if myself and my neighbor sat up, we would have to bump, so we had to kitty corner. And, like any dysfunctional family, sometimes we got along, sometimes we didn't, you know. And then I saw, you know, don't get me wrong, the owner ain't here. There were three family houses, 40 of us in there, between two floors. And no support. And then it starts out of cleaning sober house. But please, you know, then you realize sometimes the cleaning sober people don't have their rent money. But the people that you know are going to have their rent money, they're going to need somewhere to go when it's all done. And at that time, I just graduated from Maryland Village. I was living with my quote-unquote aunt in Yonkers. I was going to my welfare to work job in Yonkers. And then turn around and go to my next. And while that might seem insignificant, that's the consistency that's something that I could bank on and that was going to happen. So, anywho, long story short, as part of my condition of my graduation from Maryland Village, I had to go to 12 average. So, it was maybe like 15, 16 of us, and we were all recently graduating from the program. Right? But what happened after 16 months? Oh, I give you a cup of water, and I give you a cup, you get your own water. Now we eating out of the water fountain. Now we eating out of this and that, you know. Life is taking some very, you know, some twists and turns. I've forced myself. I brought on myself, you know. I had to learn that. And I think it's raining. I have to step back and see if I caused that thundercloud. Or, you know, I don't know. It's just, one thing I know for sure, right? Good, bad, or indifferent. The trauma, incarceration, not too sure about the removal of my child. But those things, I wouldn't trade if I could rewrite my story. Because those are the things that allow me to realize, despite what the world says in our nation, that I'm a quitter.
Thank you. And how has your involvement with the CWP impacted your goals for the future?
It allowed me access to a group of women, a group of dynamic women. Because Tamar and Jaya, I love them. You know. And during my journey in CWP, it wasn't always straight, you know? I relapsed. I got arrested again a couple of times. And each time I called either one of them, you know, whether it was Bronx Defenders or Manhattan Defenders, were there instantaneously because of their affiliation. It was my first experience of people who wouldn't give up on me.
Thank you. And I guess if you were sort of wrapping up, but if there's anything
okay.
you like to add, we still, I mean, since we started a little late, we still have, you know, we can give a little more time, like, but really it's up to you as well. Like,
you know, this journey, like, it's not over, you know what I mean? Recently, I came to realize that everybody who said they wanted me to get my life together really did. And it was hard because I realized it was my family. You know, come September 11th, 2023, I have 11 years clean. You know? Subsequently, as a result of my addiction and incarceration, my maternal aunt adopted my son. And that, you know, it participated in my last dance feeling. Because my grandmother raised me and they have a paperwork in the world. My other aunt raised my other cousin and eventually returned to a mother. I have a paperwork in the world. What was it about me that I had to write up a court? Like, that it had to be legal. That. My part in this young man's life, my son's now 18, was obliterated. Because when you adopt a child, the natural parents' names are taken off. The adopted parents. You know? What was it about me that I wasn't even worthy enough for it to be written down somewhere? I gave birth to, you know?
Well, thank you for sharing that with us, and congratulations on being 11 years clean. That's amazing.
Thank you.
And I'm so glad that you could take the time to talk with us. And I'm sure you'll be hearing from Obden soon. And yeah, I hope you have a lovely weekend and stay safe.
You too. You know, it's like, thank you guys, because like I said, you know, my aunt had adopted my son. She recently passed away. So my son's 18 now, right? But he's been so conditioned, right? And the thing about it is, I can't even be mad because I was conditioned, you know, where negative things were said about my mom, like not to my face. But I'm in the same house and you're talking about my mother. I'm going to soak that in. You know what I mean? And, you know, the thing that, you know, puts me at odds with my family because it's so facetious. You know what I mean? Your work, and I can't, I can be mad, but I can't be mad. Because I have to respect, and I don't have to accept you, but I got to respect just who you are.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like their worth is built on external stuff. And I'm not going to dance to that drum. Like, I'm not going to pitch into that party when that's not who I am. Because, not for nothing, I always tell this to people. If you put cream cheese frosting and rainbow sprinkles and pretty candles on a pile of shit at the end of the day, what is it? It's still shit. And unless it's dealt with and washed away, so it doesn't stink, you know? And an explosion is always better than an implosion, because that's when you know something's wrong. And once I decided that I was going to explode and I was going to throw up, like, all the stuff that was fed into me, you know? I'm surrounding villains. I forgave my mom, you know? Whether it was true or not, but at 16 years old, you don't even know yourself, and then you're addicted to a drug. Now you're pregnant. You don't even want yourself. How could you want another human being? You know? I said my grandmother treated me the way that she treated me because she knew at this stage in my life, I pretty was going to be on my own. Like, I had to learn how to stand on my own, too. You know? And even with the molestation by my uncle, I had to ask myself, people aren't born thinking stuff like that is okay. So what could happen to him that made him think doing it to me was okay? Yeah. And lastly, I'm walking around mad at them and they dead. They don't know it. Who suffers? Who suffers? Me, because I'm addicted to crack. My uncle, my kids, you want to, you know, take my kids, you know? And I hide behind intelligence, you know? And I walk around a dressed up bum. Because in all reality, inside is a whole mess. And I can't expect to throw that ball up in the air and all in the yard just immediately. Yeah, you know, the yellow go with the yellow, the green go with the green, the red go with the red. Because it didn't happen. So I have to unravel the ball slowly. You know. But that's about it.
I think that's a good note to end on. I'm going to go ahead and stop the recording.